or what he says is the truth, about my parents." Roger glanced at him. "Even an orphan must have had parents at one time," Fergus said, lifting one shoulder in a shrug. "I've never known anything about mine, and I take leave to doubt that Monsieur Beauchamp does either."
"But if that's the case, why pretend he does?"
"I don't know, but I suppose we're about to find out." Fergus sounded grimly resigned to the prospect. He squared his shoulders, preparing to go on, but Roger's hand hadn't left his sleeve.
"Why?"
Roger said quietly.
"Why talk to him at all?"
The Adam's apple bobbed in Fergus's lean throat as he swallowed, but he met Roger's eyes straight on.
"If I must lose my livelihood here, if I can no longer be a printer, then I must find a new place or a new way to support my family, to protect them," he said simply. "It may be that Monsieur Beauchamp will show me such a way."
The mysterious Monsieur Beauchamp's address was a grand house on Hazel Street, and Fergus's knock upon the door was answered by a butler whose livery probably cost more than Bonnie the printing press. This worthy gave no sign of wondering why two vagabonds should have appeared on his master's doorstep, but upon hearing Fergus's name, bowed low and ushered them inside. It was a hot day outside, and the thick velvet drapes at the windows were drawn to keep as much heat out as possible. They kept out all daylight as well, and the parlour into which they were shown was so dark that the single lamp on a table near the window glowed like a pearl inside an oyster. Roger thought it was rather like being inside an oyster himself, surrounded by a slick, oppressive moistness, the constant touch of mucus on the skin. Granted, the room in which they had been shut was not as searing as the glaring cobblestones outside, but it wasn't a hell of a lot cooler either. "Like being poached instead of fried," he whispered to Fergus, mopping his face with the lace-trimmed handkerchief he'd forgotten to exchange for a workman's bandana. Fergus blinked at him in momentary confusion, but before Roger could explain, the door opened and Percival Beauchamp walked in, smiling. Roger didn't know what he'd been expecting, but this chap wasn't it. Beauchamp wasn't French, for one thing. When he greeted them with great courtesy, accepted Fergus's introduction of Roger, and thanked them effusively for coming, his voice was that of an educated Englishman, but not one educated at Eton or Harrow. Roger thought that the traces of an underlying accent came from somewhere near the edges of the Thames, Southwark, or maybe Lambeth. He was dressed in the height of Paris style, or at least Roger assumed that that must be what it was, with 6-inch cuffs, a yellow silk waistcoat embroidered with swallows, and a lot of lace. He wore his own hair, though, dark and very curly, casually tied back with a plum-coloured silk ribbon.
"I thank you for your kind attention, messieurs," he said again. "Allow me to send for wine."
"Non," Fergus said. He pulled an ink-stained handkerchief from his pocket and wiped the sweat pooling in his deep eye sockets.
"This place is like a Turkish bath. I have come to hear what you have to say, monsieur. Say it."
Beauchamp pursed his lips as though about to whistle, but then relaxed, still smiling, and gestured them to a pair of ornately brocaded chairs near the empty hearth. He also went to the door and, in spite of Fergus's refusal, ordered some refreshments to be brought. When a tray of pastries with a decanter of iced negus had been delivered, he asked the butler to pour out a glass for each of them, and then sat down facing them. His eyes flickered over Roger, but all his attention was for Fergus.
"I said to you on a previous occasion, monsieur, that I wish to acquaint you with the facts of your birth. These are somewhat dramatic, and I'm afraid that you may find some of them distressing. I apologize."
"Tais-toi," Fergus said roughly. Roger didn't understand all of what he said next, but it seemed to be an invitation to Beauchamp to shit something or other, possibly the truth, out of his backside. Beauchamp blinked, but sat back, took a sip of wine, and patted his lips.
"You are the son of Le Comte Saint-Germain," he said,
and paused as though expecting a reaction. Fergus just stared at him. Roger felt a small rivulet of sweat run down the seam of his back, like water from a melting ice cube.
"And your mother's name was Amélie Élise Lavigne Beauchamp."
Roger heard Fergus's sudden intake of breath.
"You know that name?"
Beauchamp sounded surprised but eager. He leaned forward, his face intent, nacreous in the lamplight.
"J'ai connu une jeune fille de ce nom, Emily," Fergus said. "Mais elle est morte."
There was a moment's silence, broken only by the distant bustling hum of the house's domestic staff.
"She is dead?"
Beauchamp's voice was gentle, but Fergus jerked a little, as though stung by a wasp. Beauchamp drew a long, careful breath, then leaned forward.
"You knew her, you said?"
Fergus nodded once, a jerky movement quite unlike him.
"I knew her by name. I did not know she was my mother."
He caught Roger's look of surprise from the corner of his eye and turned to face him, turning a shoulder to Beauchamp, the bringer of unwelcome news.
"There are many children born in a brothel, mon frère, despite unceasing attempts to prevent them. Those pretty enough to be saleable within a few years are kept."
"And the others?"
Roger asked, not wanting to hear the answer.
"I was pretty enough," Fergus replied tersely. "And by the time I did not bruise easily, I could take care of myself on the streets."
Looking down, Roger could see that the toes of Fergus's shoes were dug hard into the carpet.
"Because there are children, there are whores with milk. Those who had lost a child would sometimes nurse other babies. If a whore was called to attend a customer and her child was hungry, she would hand him to another jeune fille. The little ones called any whore maman," he said quietly, looking down at his feet. "Anyone who would feed them."
He seemed indisposed to say anything else. Roger cleared his throat, and Beauchamp looked at him as though surprised to find him still there.
"How and when did Amélie Beauchamp die?"
Roger asked politely.
"During an outbreak of the morbid sore throat," Beauchamp said, in the same tone. "We don't know exactly when."
"I see."
Roger glanced at Fergus, who was still staring at the branching pattern of the figured carpet, saying nothing.
"And, Monsieur le Comte?"
Percival Beauchamp seemed to relax a little at this question.
"We don't know that either. Monsieur le Comte has often disappeared from Paris for varying lengths of time, sometimes days, sometimes months, now and then for a year or more, with no hint as to where he's been.
But the last time he was seen was more than 20 years ago, and the circumstances of his disappearance so remarkable that the probability that he really is dead this time is sufficient that a magistrate would undoubtedly declare him to be defunct, should a petition to that effect to be filed by his heir."
Damp with sweat as his hair was, Roger still felt it rise on his neck. Probably so had Fergus, who had looked up sharply at this news.
"Unless my understanding of the law in France has changed of late, a bastard cannot inherit property."
"Or when you say heir, are you talking of someone else?"
Beauchamp smiled at him, an evidently genuine smile of happiness, and picking up a small silver bell from the tray of refreshments, rang it. Within moments, the door opened, letting in a welcome draught of air and light from the hallway, as well as a tall gentleman in a fine grey suit. But a suit of English cut, not French. Roger thought he must be a lawyer. He looked the part, with a leather folder tucked beneath one arm.
"Mr. Beauchamp," he said, with a nod toward Percival. "And you, sir, must be Claudel, if I may use your original name."
"You may not, sir."
Fergus was sitting bolt upright and was getting his feet under him, clearly meaning to walk out. Roger thought that was likely a good idea and began to rise himself, only to be stopped by the newcomer, who held out a quelling hand, and with the other laid down his folder and opened it. There was only one document inside, old from its stained and yellowed appearance. It bore a large red wax seal, though, and multiple signatures, signed with such flourishes that it looked as though a tiny octopus had dipped its legs in ink and walked across the page. At the top of the document, however, the writing, in French, was clear and clerkish. Contract of marriage, made this day, the 14th of August, Anno Domini, 1735, between Amélie Élise Lavigne Bouchon, spinster, and Léopold Georges Simon Gervaise Racosi, Le Comte Saint-Germain.
You aren't a bastard, Percival Bouchon said, smiling warmly at Fergus. Allow me to congratulate you, sir.
Fergus knitted his brows, staring at the document, then flicked a sideways glance at Roger. Roger made a small noise in his throat, signifying willingness to follow any lead Fergus chose, but otherwise remained still. He regarded the iced negus. The decanter and glasses were filmed with condensation, and water droplets were beginning to slide down the curved glass. It would have gone down a treat in this steam bath. Bouchon and the lawyer were each holding a glass of the cold sugared port, eyes fixed expectantly on Fergus, ready to toast their revelation. Fergus straightened up and got his feet under him.
I may or may not be a bastard, gentlemen, but I am most certainly not a child.
Roger thought that was a good exit line, and also got his feet under him, but Fergus didn't stand up. He leaned forward and deliberately picked up a glass of the negus, which he passed under his nose with the air of a king compelled to inspect a chamber pot.
Here, he said to Bouchon, who was watching this with his mouth slightly open, exchange glasses with me, s'il vous plaît.
Despite the overt politeness, it wasn't a request, and Bouchon, eyebrows nearly touching his hairline, obliged. Fergus silently indicated that Roger should likewise exchange drinks with the lawyer, and this was done, Roger wondering, not for the first time, what the hell? Fergus sat back in his chair, relaxed, and lifted his glass.
To honesty, gentlemen, and honour among thieves.
Bouchon and the lawyer exchanged a nonplussed look, but then blinked and murmured the toast, glasses lifted an inch or so. Roger didn't bother with the toast, but sipped and found the negus as good as he'd thought it might be. It slid beguilingly down his parched throat, cold and warming at the same time.
Regardez,
Fergus said as the glasses came down. The air was perfumed with ruby port and the spices used in the negus. The air in the sweltering salon became a little more tolerable.
Since you are so familiar with my personal affairs, gentlemen, I presume you are aware that Lord Brochtour employed me for a time in Paris to obtain for him an assortment of useful documents. I therefore have seen many such things as that.
He lifted his glass to indicate the marriage contract on the table, infusing his voice with a touch of scorn.
Milor Brochtouroch also produced such documents, from time to time, as situations arose requiring them. I've seen it done, gentlemen, time upon time, and so you will give me leave to express some doubt regarding the veracity of this particular document.
One part of Roger's mind was admiring Fergus's performance, while another was noting in an abstract way that Jamie Fraser could never have been a forger. Left-handed, but forced from childhood to write with his right hand, and that hand very recently crushed, at the time Fergus must be referring to. On the other hand, Fergus himself was a very accomplished forger, but he supposed that wasn't something Fergus wanted to get around Charlestown society. The lawyer looked as though he'd been taxidermized by someone who hated him. But Bouchon spluttered negus and began to protest. Fergus looked at Roger, who obligingly put back his coat to show his knife and set his hand on the hilt, keeping his face impassive. Bouchon froze,
Fergus nodded approvingly.
Just so. And so, gentlemen.
Say, for the sake of argument, that persons less discerning than I might accept the truth of this document. What did you propose to do, had I been willing to do that? Plainly you had something in mind, something that Monsieur le Comte's heir might accomplish for you, eh?
Colour was coming back into Beauchamp's face, and the lawyer lost a little of his stuffing. They exchanged glances, and some decision was made.
All right.
Percival Beauchamp sat up straight and touched a linen napkin to his port-stained lips.
This is the situation.
The situation, as explained by Beauchamp, with minor interruptions from the lawyer, was that the Comte Saint-Germain, a very wealthy man, had owned, well, still did own, technically, a majority of the stock of a syndicate investing in land in the New World. The main asset of this syndicate was a large piece of land in the very large area known as the Northwest Territory. Fergus managed to look as though he knew exactly what this was, and quite possibly he did, but it rang only faint bells of recognition for Roger. It was a lot of land in the far north, and was part of what the French and Indian War had been fought over. And the British had won, he was pretty sure of that. Evidently the French, or some portion of the French, whom Beauchamp referred to obliquely as our interests, were not so sure. And now that France had officially entered the war in alliance with the Americans, Beauchamp's interests had it in mind to take the first steps towards securing at least a foothold on the territory.
By establishing Mr. Freezer's claim to it.
Roger hadn't said anything to this point, but sheer astonishment compelled him. The lawyer gave him an austere look, but Beauchamp inclined his head gracefully. Yes. But the claim of an individual alone would not likely stand against the rapacity of the Americans. Therefore, our interests will assist Mr. Fraser in establishing colonists upon his land, French-speaking colonists, who would thus provide substance for a claim by France once the war is over. Whereupon, Beauchamp concluded, our interests would purchase the land from you for a significant sum.
If the Americans win, Fergus said, sounding sceptical. If they don't, I fear your interests will be in a precarious position, as would I. They'll win.
The lawyer hadn't spoken since greeting them, and his voice gave Roger a start. It was deep and assured, in contrast with Beauchamp's light charm.
You're a rebel, are you not, Mr. Fraser?
The lawyer raised a brow at Fergus.
That is certainly the impression given by your newspaper. Have you no faith in your own cause?
Fergus raised his hook and scratched delicately behind one ear.
I assume you have noticed that the streets are filled with Continental soldiers, sir? Should I put my family in danger by advocating their confusion in print?
He didn't wait for an answer to this question, but rose suddenly to his feet.
Bonjour, monsieur, he said. You have given me much to think about.
Roger felt a strong inclination to be somewhere else, and thus didn't question Fergus's plunging suddenly into a narrow alley between two houses, running down it, and zigging through a gate into the backyard of what appeared to be a brothel, judging from the laundry hanging limply in the humid air. He was somewhat surprised when Fergus, with a cordial word to two black maidservants folding sheets, went up the back steps and entered the house without knocking. "Mr. Fergus!" cried a young lady running down the hall toward them. The girl, God, she couldn't be more than 12, could she? Flung herself affectionately into Fergus's arms, kissed him on the cheek, and then turned her head coquettishly toward Roger.
"Oh, you've brought a friend."
"Allow me to introduce my brother, the Reverend, Mademoiselle."
"Reverend?"
"Mademoiselle Marigold."
"Of course she is,"
Roger said, collecting his wits just in time to bow to the lady who received his homage with a demure downward sweep of her shadowed eyelids.
"We get quite a number of reverent gentlemen, sir,"
she assured him, laughing gaily.
"Don't be shy. Remember, we've all seen one before."
"One?"
he began, rather stunned.
Why, one clergyman, she said, dimpling, at least.
She was dressed rather sedately, for a brothel, his mind amended, which is to say she was covered, even to her feet, which were clad in smart leather boots. He didn't have time to consider what her function in the establishment might be, too expensively dressed to be a maid, before Fergus set her gently but firmly on her feet.
Is the second floor parlour available, Sherry?
Roger had a moment to notice that the girl was black, of a pale coffee colour, and with hair like smooth coils of molasses taffy. She was also somewhat older than he'd thought, perhaps in her late teens, and with a shrewd glint behind the playful air.
If you don't need it more than an hour, she said, someone's coming at 4 o'clock.
That will be sufficient, Fergus assured her. We only require a place to sit down and collect ourselves. Though I suppose a glass of wine might not be out of the question.
She looked at him for a moment, head on one side, like a bird estimating whether that fallen leaf might hide a juicy worm, but then nodded, matter-of-factly.
I'll send Barbara up with it. Adieu, mon brave,
she said, and kissing her fingertips, applied them briefly to Roger's surprised cheek before skipping off down the hall, which, he saw, was not unlike that of a house they had just come from, though the art on display was considerably better.
Come, Fergus murmured, touching his arm.
The second-floor parlour was a small, charming room with French doors opening onto a small balcony and long lace curtains that barely stirred in the heavy air when they stepped in.
I am a son of the house, so to speak, Fergus said,
sitting down with a brief wave of the hand toward the door.
I didn't ask,
Roger murmured, and Fergus laughed.
You needn't ask if Massali knows about this place either, he assured Roger. I won't say I have no secrets for my wife. I think every man must require a few secrets. But this is not one of them.
Roger's heart was beginning to slow down, and he fished out a semi-clean handkerchief with which to mop his face. He found himself avoiding the tiny patch Miss Marigold's fingers had touched, and scrubbed it briefly before putting the hanky away.
The men we have just left, Fergus said, dabbing his own face. I recognize them. Yes? The fop. This is Percival Bouchon, though I believe he used another name, perhaps more than one. He has approached me more than once with a similar tarradiddle that I was the son of a high-born man, had title to land.
He made a very French grimace of disdain, and Roger, already entertained by his pronunciation of tarradiddle, made a similar grimace in order to keep from laughing.
Now, Fergus went on, hunching closer and lowering his voice, at that time he was attending Le Comte de La Fayette as some sort of aide-de-camp. I dismissed him. I had met him once before that, and refused to speak with him then, and he went so far as to threaten me. Chien, he added with contempt. Chien?
Roger asked, careful with the pronunciation.
You think he's a female dog?
Fergus looked surprised.
Well, there are other words,
he said, and wrinkled his brow as though trying to summon a few.
But surely you noticed.
A wave of heat that had nothing to do with the atmosphere rose behind Roger's ears.
Actually, no. I just thought he was, Frenchman. Ornamental, you know.
Fergus burst out laughing. Roger coughed.
So, you're saying that Percival, whatever he's calling himself, is what people in Scotland might call a Nancy boy. Do you think that's got anything to do with the present situation?
Fergus was still simmering with mirth, but he shook his head.
Oui, but perhaps only because a man with such tastes, when they are known, and plainly they are, cannot be trusted, because he's always subject to the threat of public exposure. You must look at the man who controls him.
Roger felt a touch of uneasiness. Well, in honesty, he'd been uneasy since they walked into the house on Hazel Street.
Who do you suppose that is?
Fergus glanced at him in surprise, then shook his head in mild reproof.
I tell you, mon frère, you require a great deal more experience in the fields of sin if you hope to be a good minister.
You're suggesting that I send for Miss Marigold and ask for lessons?
Well, no, Fergus said, giggling slightly.
Your wife would, but that's not what I meant.
Only that your own goodness, which is undeniable...
He smiled at Roger with a warmth in his eyes that touched Roger deeply.
Is one thing, but to help those of your flock who lack that goodness, you need to understand something of evil, and thus the struggle that afflicts them.
I wouldn't say you're wrong, Roger said warily, but I know more than one man of the cloth who's got himself in serious trouble while seeking that sort of education.
Fergus lifted one shoulder, laughing.
You can learn a great deal from horse, mon frère, but I agree that perhaps you should not make such inquiries alone.
Still, he said sobering, that's not what I meant by evil.
No, but you said you had passages with this Percival before. He didn't strike me as...
He's not. He's a whore. He has likely been one all his life.
Seeing Roger's expression, he didn't smile, but one corner of his mouth lifted.
What is it, they say? It takes one to know one.
Roger felt a sudden contraction of his stomach muscles, as though he'd been lightly punched. He'd known that Fergus had been a child whore in Paris before encountering Jamie Fraser, who had engaged him as a pickpocket, but he'd forgotten.
Monsieur Bouchon is too old to sell his ass, of course, but he will sell himself.
From necessity, Fergus added dispassionately. A person who has lived like that for a long time ceases to believe that they have any value beyond what someone will pay for.
Roger was silent, thinking not so much of the recent Percival Bouchon, but of Fergus, and of Jane and Fanny Pocock.
When you say evil, though, he began slowly. There were only two men in that room, Fergus said simply. Besides us, I mean. Jesus.
He tried to think what the tall man had said or done that might have given Fergus the conviction, and it was a conviction, he could see that much in Fergus's face, that the man was evil.
I can't even remember what he looked like. In my experience, the devil seldom walks up and introduces himself to you by name, Fergus said dryly. All I can tell you is that I know evil when I see it, and I saw it on that man.
Fergus stood up and went to the window, pulling back the lace curtain to look out. He drew a large black bandana out of his pocket and wiped his face with it.
So the ink stains don't show, he said briefly, seeing Roger notice. So, what do you plan to do about this, if anything?
Fergus exhaled strongly through his long French nose.
You tell me that the city will soon fall to the British. These crétins offer me ridiculous daydreams, but...
He raised a monetary hook to stop Roger butting in.
They do have money, and they do mean business. I just don't know what sort of business, and the guardian angel on my shoulder thinks I don't want to find out. Wise man, your guardian angel.
Fergus nodded and was still, staring at the river in the distance as it went about its murky business. After a moment, he glanced at Roger.
Brianna told Marsali that Lord John Grey had promised her a military escort to see her safely to Savannah.
Yes, but we don't need it. No one's going to bother a wagon full of children and sauerkraut.
Nonetheless,
Fergus stood up and shucked his coat, plucking the soaked linen of his shirt away from his chest.
Will you ask your wife to send a note to Lord John at once, please? Ask him to send his escort as soon as possible. We're coming with you. I think the printing press might draw notice.
Chapter 75. No smoke without fire. Brianna awoke suddenly, in the disoriented state that occurs when you've gone to sleep in a strange place and don't recall immediately where you are. She'd been dreaming. Of what? Her heart was racing, and any minute it was going to... Damn! The wings started fluttering in her chest like a flock of agitated bats trapped in her shift. She sat up, cursing under her breath, and struck herself hard in the chest, in hopes of startling her heartbeat back into regularity. Sometimes that worked. Not this time. She swung her feet out of bed, planted them on the cold, damp floorboards, and took a deep breath, only to cough and let it out with a gasp.
"Roger,"
she whispered as loudly as she could, trying not to wake the children to panic, and shook him by the arm.
"Roger, get up. I smell smoke."
She remembered now where they were. They were sleeping in the loft, and with her eyes no longer clouded by sleep, now she could see the smoke she was smelling, white wisps slipping over the edge of the loft like ghosts, moving silently but with horrifying speed.
"Jesus Christ!"
Roger was up, naked and dishevelled. She could see him in the dim cloud glow from the owl slits.
"Bloody hell! Go down and rouse everybody. I'll grab the kids."
He was moving even as he said it, snatching a shirt off a stack of cheap Bibles. A scream of pure terror from below split the air, followed by an instant of stunned silence, and then a lot of yelling, in French, English, and Gaelic, plus piercing shrieks from the babies. "They're roused," she said, and pushing past Roger, ran to scoop up Mandy, who was sitting up in her nest of quilts, squint-eyed and cross.
"You're too noisy,"
she said accusingly to her mother.
"You woke me up."
Brianna repressed the urge to say, "You can sleep when you're dead," and instead grabbed Esmeralda and shoved her into Mandy's arms. She could hear Roger behind her trying to rouse Jemmy, who was dead to the world and planned to stay that way.
"Come on," she said to Mandy, who was slowly picking some sort of fuzz off her shift. "You can do that later. Hold on."
With Mandy whining and clinging to her neck like a cranky gibbon, and Esmeralda, a solid lump mashed between them, she made her way one-handed backward down the ladder, bare toes curling to keep a grip on the foot-worn rungs. The smell of smoke was stronger now, but not choking, not yet. Tendrils rose past her toward the ceiling, coiling in slow-growing clouds under the beams as she looked up.
"Get out! Get out!"
someone was bellowing, louder than the rest. And as she hit the bottom of the ladder and turned, she saw Germain, wild with fear and furious with it, pulling one of his screaming sisters, by her hair, toward the door, kicking at the other who was scrambling round on the floor, evidently looking for something.
"Va-t'en, j'ai dit!"
he was shouting. "Move, salope! Move!"
"Germain!"
Missali, white-faced, had both babies in her arms, a leather bag pressed between them. Germain heard her and turned, his face 10 years older than he was, drawn with terror and determination.
"Je ne laisserai pas ça se reproduire,"
he said to Missali, and shoved Félicité hard toward the door, then bent and yanked Joni off the floor, wrestling her outside as she wailed and struggled. There was a sudden loud crack and a thump. Brianna turned to see Roger and Jem in a heap on the floor, the ladder skewed sideways, a rung hanging loose where it had given way under their combined weights.
"Get up, da! Mama! Mama!"
Jem ran to her and clung. She grabbed him with one arm and hugged him hard, then let go and pushed him toward the open door. Damp night air whooshed into the room, a welcome freshness and an instant danger. Bree saw, seeing the smoke whirl up in a frenzy as the cold air touched it. Roger was crouched on one knee at the foot of the ladder, trying to stand.
"Take Mandy outside,"
she said to Jem, who was standing in the middle of the floor, looking lost.
"Now!"
And thrusting Mandy and Esmeralda into his arms, she ran to Roger and grabbed his arm, got a shoulder under it, and managed somehow to get him on his feet. And then they were shuffling and staggering like people in a three-legged race, bumping off counters and knocking over tables, books, papers.
"My God, the whole place will go up like a torch!"
And then they were outside in the street, all of them, coughing, crying, touching each other, counting noses again and again.
"Where's Fergus?"
Roger asked, his voice rasping. Roger found Fergus a few moments later at the back of the print shop, stamping out the last fragments of a small fire that had been built against the back door. The door itself was charred at the bottom, but the only remaining traces of the fire were a large black spot on the ground, a few scattered chunks of greying ember, and a small cloud of ashes and flecks of half-burnt paper that flew around Fergus's stamping feet like a cloud of black and white moths.
"Mert,"
Fergus said, noticing Roger.
"May we?"
Roger replied, coughing slightly from the drifting smoke.
"One of your competitors?"
He nodded at the half-burnt door where someone had painted the words "Next Time" in dripping whitewash. Fergus shook his head, teeth clenched. His hair was standing on end, and like Roger, he wore nothing but a nightshirt, though he'd had the presence of mind to put on his boots before running outside. The fire was out, but Roger felt the heat from the smoking door on his bare legs.
"Loyalists,"
Fergus said briefly, and coughed hard. Roger felt the tickle of smoke in his own throat and cleared it hard in hopes of quelling it. Coughing still hurt.
"Masali and Bree and the Weans are all right," Roger said.
Fergus nodded, cleared his throat, and spat into the ashes.
"I know,"
he said, with a slight relaxation of his hard-lined face.
"I heard them cursing. Les femmes sauvages."
Roger hadn't noticed the cursing, but he didn't doubt it.
"Have they tried before?"
he asked, lifting his chin at the paint-smeared door. Fergus lifted one shoulder in a Gallic shrug.
"Letters, filth, a bag full of dead rats, another bag with a live serpent. Luckily it was a rattlesnake and not a cottonmouth. Masali heard it before she picked the bag up." "Jesus Christ."
It was something between a curse and a prayer, and Fergus nodded, appreciating both.
"Les enfants savants qu'il ne faut rien toucher près de la porte,"
he said matter-of-factly. He took a deep, slow breath and shook his head at the door.
"This is..."
His lips tightened and he glanced at Roger.
"You know, Milady Amiral told you, I expect, what happened to our little one, Henri Christian?"
The name came hesitantly, as though it had been a long time since Fergus had spoken it aloud.
"I do,"
Roger said, a lump in his throat making the words come out low and choked. He cleared it hard.
"Fucking cowardly wankers. If you care to call them that."
Fergus was white around the mouth.
"Cowards, certainly. Canaille."
He kicked the door so hard that it juddered in its frame. Recovering from shock and panic, Roger found his own anger rising.
"Those shits. Setting a fire where your family lives. Your kids. And mine. As a warning, it's much more effective than anonymous notes pushed under the door."
Fergus was breathing heavily and stopped to cough, shaking his head. He glared at Roger, eyes bloodshot with smoke.
"If I find out who did this, I will tie them in a sack, roll them out to sea, and throw them alive to the sharks. I swear it by the name of God and La Virgin."
"I'll help you do it."
He'd have to, he thought. Fergus couldn't row with one hand.
"Merci."
Fergus glanced bleakly at the corner of the house. The shrieks and crying of frightened children in the streets on the other side had died down, smothered in the sounds of running footsteps and exclamations.
"I will find out," he said, suddenly calm. "But now I must go to Masali." Jesus, what the thought of another fire will have done to him and Masali, the little girls.
He felt his blood go cold in his veins at the thought. Fergus was watching his face. He nodded, his own face sober now, and together they went to find their wives and children. There was a lot of clishmaclaver going on outside the print shop. Dawn was an hour off, and there was barely enough light to see Missali and Bree and all the kids withdrawn to the far side of the street and huddled together in the dark like a herd of small bison. Germain, with Jemmy stoutly by his side, was standing in front of the women and children, fists clenched, and his face, too, looking as though he couldn't decide whether to cry or pound somebody. Fergus exhaled through his teeth, clapped Germain on the shoulder, and went to take one of the twins from Missali, who had them both in a death grip. Fergus said something very quiet to her in French, and Roger turned tactfully to Bree, who had sat down on the wooden sidewalk, and gathered all three little girls around her. Fizzy was clinging to Bree's shift and sniffing, and Joni, who tended to be practical, was braiding Mandy's hair.
"You're all right," Roger said,
and rested his hand on Brianna's head, her hair cool and damp in the morning fog off the harbour. "Nobody died," she said, and managed a small shaky laugh.
"Do you know what happened?" "Sort of. Tell you later, though."
Other people were coming, some in their nightclothes, others on their way from or to work. Bakers, tavern keepers, labourers, fishermen. Two whores hung about under a tree, whispering to each other and glancing from the print shop to the family. Rather to Roger's surprise, Fergus made no attempt at secrecy. He told everyone in turn exactly what had happened and what he intended to do to the maudit chien who had attacked his family and livelihood. Roger, catching on, searched the faces as the light began to seep slowly through the fog, looking for anyone who seemed maliciously pleased or too knowing. Everyone seemed honestly shocked, though, and one tall, handsome, middle-aged woman, who by her dress could be nothing other than the landlady of a prosperous tavern, came up to Missali and urged her to bring the babes along and come and have a bite of breakfast. "On the house," she added, looking at the children and quite obviously reckoning up the cost of their appetites.
"Well, I thank you kindly, Mistress Kenny," Missali said.
She glanced at Fergus and coughed a little. "If you'll give us a moment to go and put some clothes on." The remark caused Roger to realize that he was standing in the street barefoot, wearing nothing but a shirt. He helped collect the children, and as they started to trickle back across the street toward their threatened home, he saw that Missali was carrying several slugs of type, evidently snatched from the type case, under one arm. They looked heavy, and she let him take them from her, sighing with relief as he did.
"You do wonder what you'll take if the house was afire," he said,
trying to be humorous.
"I will,"
Missali said, tucking in the blankets wrapped around the twin she was holding.
"It smells that wee bit better than sauerkraut, eh?"
4 days later, Brianna took a handful of the dress she meant to wear and lifted it cautiously to her nose. She'd hung it on a peg in the airing cupboard, along with Masali's working dress and apron, hoping for the best. The cupboard itself was no more than a large box like a coffin stood on end, built against the bedroom wall, and pierced with dozens of holes through the outside wall to let the night air dispel as much of the scent of lamp black, varnish, ink, cooking grease, and infant spit up as possible before the garments were resumed the next morning. "All right?" Missali inquired, tousled blonde head emerging from her night-freshened shift.
"Well, it doesn't smell very much like sauerkraut," Bree said, inhaling strongly,
and Missali gave the breath of a laugh and reached into the cupboard, snagging her work gown, a butternut grey homespun in a severe cut that made Brianna think privately of a Civil War uniform.
"You'll be aired out fine by the time you reach Savannah," Missali assured her, "and the soldiers will not care."
She handed Brianna a couple of petticoats and went on with her own dressing, fingers rapid with tapes, laces, and buttons. It was just before dawn, and they were talking in whispers not to wake the children before they had to. Downstairs, shuffling and muffled thumps and sniggers signalled Roger's and Fergus's preparations for the day. The soldiers Lord John had sent were already outside. Brianna had seen them from the loft where the Mackenzies had been sleeping, a small group of men who stood together in the alley behind the shop. They'd taken up station a little distance from the house, smoking pipes that glowed briefly in the dark as they moved, and were murmuring to one another, shadowy figures noticeable as soldiers only by the long black shapes of their muskets, stacked together against a wall that had just begun to emerge from the night. She couldn't see them from the bedroom, window taxis being what they were. The only windows in the house were the large front windows of the print shop, but a faint scent of tobacco reached her through the holes of the airing cupboard, and she exhaled sharply. It would be a long time before she quit smelling sauerkraut, but at least the reeking barrels wouldn't be accompanying her and the kids to Savannah. Both whiskey and the remaining gold, neatly repackaged as a crate of salt fish, had been discreetly spirited away to a warehouse whose owner was a son of liberty, and while she still had a few of the thin gold strips sewn into her clothes, it wasn't enough gold to be really suspicious, even if someone discovered one of the strips. Nowhere near enough to buy guns, she thought, and shivered, though Masali had just poked up the bedroom fire. A muffled squawk from the next room made Masali put down the poker and hurry off, loosening her freshly donned stays as the milk surged into her breasts. Bree saw the wet patches spring out on Masali's shift. She could feel it in sympathetic memory, her own nipples swelling against her stays. "Ma'am," said Jemmy, sticking his head into the room. The new fire caught the gleam of his hair and shadowed his bones, and quite suddenly she saw what he would look like grown. Quick humour and a latent fierceness showed in his face, and the sight of it struck her to the heart.
Warrior. Oh, God.
She closed her eyes and sent a quick, passionate plea to the Virgin Mother. Please, keep him out of it. A calming thought came, perhaps in response. 2 years, almost exactly 2 years to the Battle of Yorktown and the end of the war. Only 2 years. Jem was 9, and 11 would still be much too young to fight. She pushed away the sudden vision of a drummer boy. Yes, honey, she said, tucking in the ends of her fichu. Are you and Mandy ready? He shrugged. How was he supposed to know?
Dar says, will you need one of the pistols?
He spoke casually. It was no big deal. She'd been armed all the way from the ridge and thought little of it, but now there were soldiers outside, enemy soldiers, waiting to take her and her children away.
Tell him, yes, she said, I think I'd better have one.
Chapter 76 A Thief in the Night, Fraser's Ridge. Jamie woke up hard, his heart pounding and his mind full of shredded dreams. There was a faint memory of fury. He'd been fighting, wanting to fight someone, but it wasn't anger pulsing through him, or not entirely. It was still black dark, the shutters closed, and the air warm and bitter with the smell of ash from the smouldering hearth. Claire stirred briefly beside him, then relaxed back into sleep with a sigh. Sassenach, he whispered, and put a hand on the warm round of her hip. He felt guilt at rousing her, but his need of her was overwhelming.
I need to,
he whispered, already sliding down behind her, fumbling through the bedclothes, her night rail, his shirt. He rose up and yanked the shirt off, threw it on the floor, and then lay down again, pulled up her shift, and put an arm over her, clutching her to him, urgent. She gave a sleepy huff of surprise, but then made a small, accommodating movement of her naked backside and relaxed again, opening to him. She was surprisingly slippery, as though she'd shared his lustful dream, and perhaps she had. He came into her as slowly as he could, but he couldn't wait.
I'm sorry,
he whispered into her hair, moving in her, unable to think, to talk.
I have to.
She wasn't quite awake, he could tell,
but her body was compliant, yielding to his importunity. He quit talking and buried his face in her hair, holding her tight and rocking hard, her back hot against his chest and his cold skin rippling with goose flesh as he felt the surge come and yielded to it, shuddering and gasping as it pulsed through him.
"I'm sorry,"
he whispered again, a few moments later. She reached back, groping blindly, found his leg and patted him briefly. She yawned, stretched a little, and curled back into sleep, her bare bottom snug and warm in the damp curve of his thighs. He fell asleep as though he'd been pitched headfirst down a well, and slept without dreaming until he woke just before dawn, before the roosters. He lay quiet, watching the faint light begin to glow between the shutters, and enjoying the momentary sense of deep peace. Claire was still asleep, her breathing slow and even, and her hair pouring over the pillow like smoke. The sight of her shoulder, bare where her night rail had slipped off, brought back the sense of that midnight urgency, and he felt a mingled sense of shame and exultation. He hadn't bothered looking for his shirt in the night, and his own shoulders were cold, the smoured fire not yet stirred. Moving carefully, so as to let her sleep while she could, he drew the quilt up over both of them and lay still, eyes half closed. His mind felt as lazy as his body, not forming real thoughts, but letting idle bits of fancy and memory drift through like leaves borne along on the current of a highland burn. And among the remembered bits of dreams recalled, he saw a face, black-rimmed spectacles, an open, searching face from the back of a book. A face that rose above his own, without spectacles, searching, trying to fix his gaze, to make him look at what... His eyes sprang open in shock. Outside, the first rooster began to crow.
"Why did you never tell me that Frank Randall looked like Black Jack?"
Jamie asked abruptly. "What?" I'd wondered what was bothering him. He'd gone out before I was dressed and without his breakfast. Now it was past noon. He hadn't been fed lunch, and he'd walked into my surgery without hesitance or greeting to ask me this. Well, I tried to gather my thoughts enough to frame a coherent answer. Plainly, he needed as much truth as I could give him. Well, to begin with, he didn't, really. I mean, the first time I met Jack Randall, I was startled by the resemblance. And a few times thereafter. But that seemed to wear off. It was, I corrected myself, only a superficial physical resemblance. And once I was acquainted with Jack Randall... A surprisingly cold sensation centered itself on the back of my neck as though the gentleman in question was standing behind me, eyes fixed on me. He didn't remind me of Frank at all. I looked him over carefully. He'd been quite as usual the night before, or more so. He'd made love to me in my sleep, silently, quickly, and vigorously, and then had clasped me to his bosom and gone instantly to sleep with a murmured, "Tanka, Mokrai.
I'm sorry."
I'd fallen back asleep myself almost at once, feeling a pleasant fricative glow in my inward parts, and the slow, steady thump of his heart against my back. It wasn't that he'd never done anything like that before, but it had been some time since he had. "Besides," I said slowly, "you've seen that photo of Frank on his book. Didn't you see the resemblance for yourself then?" "No." He seemed to realize that he was looming over me, and with an impatient gesture, he pulled out one of my stools and sat down. "No," he repeated.
"And now I'm wondering why not. It's maybe what you say, that what Frank is, what he was," he corrected himself, "shows in his face. Jack Randall hid himself, but once you'd seen him look at you like what he was, you'd never see him otherwise, no matter how fine his clothes or how civil his manner."
"Yes." I shivered involuntarily and reached for my green shawl, wrapping it round my shoulders as though it might be some protection from the memory of evil. "But why did the family resemblance strike you now?"
Mm-hmm.
The three remaining fingers of his right hand drummed soundlessly on his knee, and I could feel his struggle to put what he felt into words. Did something happen? I asked cautiously, thinking of that hasty midnight coupling. That seemed the only mildly unusual event I could recall, but I failed entirely to see any connection. Jamie sighed.
Aye. Maybe. I dinna ken for sure. It's just I was dreaming.
He saw me react to that and made a slight calming gesture.
Not one of the bad ones. Just bits of nonsense. I dreamed I was reading a book. Well, I had been reading it just before I came to bed.
Frank's book, you mean?
Aye. What I was reading in the dream didn't make sense, but it went in and out, Ken, like dreams do. And it began to seem that the book was talking to me. And then it was the man himself. Just wee bits of conversation. And then I'd be reading again, or I was somewhere else.
He rubbed a hand hard over his face. I couldn't tell whether he was trying to erase the dream or bring it to the surface.
I was looking into his face, seeing his eyes behind the spectacles. Kind, decent, telling me things about history. And then I saw Jack Randall sitting back behind his desk, looking at me, mild and civil, like he might have been asking, did I want sugar in my tea? But what he was asking was whether I'd rather be buggered or flogged to death.
I leaned forward and took his hand. His fingers curled round mine at once and squeezed lightly in reassurance. It hadn't been one of the bad ones, the dreams that left him sweating and unable to be touched.
You knew it was a dream then, I ventured. You weren't, living in it, I mean.
He shook his head, his eyes on the floor.
No, but it was then I suddenly realized how much they looked alike. And I woke up wondering why you never mentioned that.
Frankly, I smiled, despite myself, and started over. I mean, at first, I didn't see any need. And later, I thought you might be upset, or worried, to know that the man I'd been married to looked so much like Jack Randall. He nodded a little, considering that.
I might have been. As you say, nae point after all. You were mine.
He lifted his head as he said this, and while there was warmth in his eyes, his mouth had firmed in a very determined way.
Oh,
I said, suddenly face to face with exactly what I'd blindly experienced in the musky depths of the night before. He'd wakened with Frank in his mind, and had promptly laid claim to me. So that's why you kept saying you were sorry. He gave me a look in which sheepishness was mingled with a certain defiance.
Well, I felt bad for waking you, but I had to...
He made a brief but very explicit gesture with his thumb in the palm of my hand, which brought warm blood flooding to my face.
Oh, I said again.
I noticed that he wasn't asking if I'd minded.
A moot point, since I hadn't.
I folded my fingers round his large, warm thumb.
Well, he smiled at me, leaned forward, and kissed my forehead.
Claire, he said softly, you are my life. You are blood of my blood and bone of my bone. If Frank felt as much for you, and Kent had taken you from him, and he did know I had, then he had good cause to try to damage or kill me.
Sheer astonishment silenced me for a moment.
You think, I mean...
No.
I shook my head hard. No. Even if you're right about that book, and I don't think you are, how could he possibly know that Brianna would bring it to the past and that you'd see it? Beyond that, how could anything in a book kill you?
And besides, I added firmly, sitting up straight and folding my hands on my knee.
Whatever resemblance your dream showed you, Frank was nothing like Jack Randall. He was a very good man. More important, he was an historian. he couldn't, he really couldn't, write something he knew was false. Jamie was regarding me with a slight smile.
I notice you're not saying that he didn't value you as much as I do.
I would have given a lot to be able to make an appropriate Scottish noise in response to this, but some things were beyond my capabilities. Instead, I reached out and took his maimed hand between mine, lightly tracing the thick white scar where his fourth finger had been. I cleared my throat. "You sent me back to him," I said, trying to keep my voice from breaking, "when you thought it would be dangerous for me and the baby to stay. He knew you weren't dead, and didn't tell me." I lifted his hand and kissed it. "I'm going to burn that bloody book." Chapter 77. City of Brotherly Love, Philadelphia. Ian found the house where Uncle Jamie had told him, at the end of a ragged dirt lane off the main road from Philadelphia. Uncle Jamie had said it was a poor household, and it looked it. It also looked deserted. A few early snowflakes were falling in a desultory sort of way, but there was no chimney smoke. The yard was overgrown, the roof sagged, half its shingles split or curled, and the door looked as though whoever lived there was in the habit of entering the house by kicking it in. He swung down from his horse, but paused for a moment, considering. His uncle's instructions were clear enough, but from the things Uncle Jamie hadn't said, it was also clear that Mrs. Hardman might have occasional male visitors of a possibly dangerous disposition, and Ian wasn't wanting to walk into anything unexpected. He tied the gelding loosely to a small elm sapling that leaned drunkenly over the lane, and walked quietly into the brush beyond it. He meant to come up to the house from the rear and listen for sounds of occupation, but as he rounded the corner of the house, he heard the faint sound of a baby's cry. It wasn't coming from the house, but from a dilapidated shed nearby. No sooner had he turned in that direction than the cry ceased abruptly, cut off in mid-wail. He kent enough about babes by now to be sure that the only thing that would shut an unhappy child up so abruptly was something stuffed in its mouth, whether that was a breast, a sugar tit, or someone's thumb, and he didn't think this Mrs. Hardman would be feeding her wane in the shed. If someone had stopped the baby crying, they'd likely already seen him. He'd taken the precaution of loading and priming his pistol at the end of the lane, and now drew it.
"Don't shoot! Don't shoot!"
The words were not shouted, but hissed, somewhere around the level of his knees. He glanced down, startled, and beheld a young girl crouched under a bush, a ragged shawl around her shoulders for warmth.
"Ah, I suppose you'd be Miss Hardman," he asked, putting his pistol back in his belt, "or one of them."
"I'm Patience Hardman."
She hunched wearily, but met his eyes straight on.
"Who is thee?"
He'd got the right place then.
He squatted companionably in front of her.
"My name is Ian Murray, lass. My Uncle Jamie is a friend of your mother's, if your ma'am's name is Sylvia, that is."
She was still looking at him, but her face had frozen in an expression of dislike when he mentioned Uncle Jamie.
"Go away," she said, "and tell thy uncle to stop coming here."
He looked her over carefully, but she seemed to be in her right mind. Homely as a board fence, but sensible enough.
"I think we may be talking of different men, lassie. My uncle is Jamie Fraser of Fraser's Ridge in North Carolina. He stayed with your family for a day or two some time past."
He counted backward in his head and found an approximation.
"It would have been maybe 2 weeks before the battle at Monmouth. Will you have heard of that one?"
Evidently she had, for she scrambled out of the bush in such a hurry as to snag both limp brown hair and ratty shawl, and emerged covered with dead leaves.
"Jamie Fraser? A very large Scottish man with red hair and a bad back?"
"That's the one," Ian said, and smiled at her. "Will your ma'am be at home, maybe? My uncle sent me to see to her welfare."
She stood as though turned to stone, but her eyes darted toward the house behind him and then toward the shed with something between excitement and dread.
"Who is he talking to, Patience?"
said another little girl's voice, and what must from her resemblance to Patience be Prudence Hardman, poked a capped head out of the shed, squinting nearsightedly.
"Just that he has eaten all the apples, and she will not be quiet."
Chastity wouldn't. There was another high-pitched scream from the shed, and Prudence's head vanished abruptly. Not a babe, then. If Uncle Jamie had met Chastity on his visit, she might be nearly two by now.
"Is your mother in the house, then?" Ian asked, deciding that he could wait to meet Chastity.
"She is, friend," Patience said, and swallowed. "But she is occupied."
"I'll wait, then."
"No! They must go away. Come back, please come back, but go now."
"Aye?"
He eyed the house curiously. He thought he heard vague sounds within, but the breeze rustling in the surrounding trees made it hard to tell what was going on.
"Not that I couldn't guess, with the lasses out here shivering in the shade."
But if Sylvia Hardman was entertaining a caller, it might be best to wait until the man had left. Still, it troubled him to go away and leave the wee girls in such a state. Perhaps he could feed them, at least. While he havered, though, Chastity took things into her own hands, screaming like a catamount and apparently kicking Prudence in the shins, for Prudence shrieked too.
"Oh, Chastity, thee bit me!"
Patience jerked, then ran for the shed, calling, "Be quiet, be quiet!" in an urgent voice, glancing frantically over her shoulder. The door of the house was jerked open, slamming back against the wall within, and a large man wearing nothing but unfastened breeches came out, a leather belt in his hand, and fury on his face.
"God damn you, Chits! You come out here, I'm going to give you all what for, and I mean it."
"Mr. Fredericks, please come back. The girls didn't mean to..." Without a second's hesitation, Mr. Fredericks turned and slapped the woman behind him across the face with his belt. Behind Ian, Patience let out a scream of pure rage and lunged for the porch. Ian caught her with an arm around her waist and put her behind him.
"Go to your sisters," he said,
and shoved her toward the shed. "Now!"
"Who the devil are you?"
Fredericks had come off the porch and was advancing on Ian, sandy hair ruffled like a lion's mane and a look on his broad red face that made his intentions clear. Ian drew his pistol and pointed it at the man.
"Leave," he said. "Now."
Fredericks snapped the belt so fast that Ian scarcely saw it, only felt the blow that knocked the gun from his hand. He didn't bother trying to pick it up, but grabbed the end of the belt as it rose for another blow and jerked Fredericks toward him, butting him in the face as he stumbled. Ian missed the nose, though, and Fredericks' jawbone slammed into his forehead, making his eyes water. He tripped Fredericks, but the man had his arms around Ian's body and they both went down, landing with a thud among the dead leaves. Ian grabbed a handful and smashed them up into the man's face, grinding them into his eyes, and got his own leg up in time to avoid being kneed in the balls. There was a lot of screaming going on. Ian got hold of Frederick's ear and did his best to twist it off while kicking and squirming. He heaved and rolled and got on top then, and got his hands round Frederick's throat, but it was a fat throat, slippery with sweat, and he couldn't get a good grasp, not with the man hammering his ribs with a fist like a rock. "Enough of this foolishness," said the mohawk part of him, and he took his hand off Frederick's throat, grabbed a sturdy stick from the litter on the ground, and drove it straight into the man's eye. Frederick threw his arms wide, went stiff, gasped once or twice, and died. Ian moved off the man's body slowly, his own body pulsing with his heartbeat. His finger hurt. He jammed it, and his hand was slimy. He wiped it on his breeches, recalling too late that they were his good pair. The screaming had stopped abruptly. He sat still, breathing. The snowflakes were coming down faster now and melted as they touched his skin, tiny cold kisses on his face. His eyes were closed, but he dimly perceived footsteps and opened them to see the woman crouching beside him. There was a wide red welt across her face. Her upper lip was split, and a trickle of blood had stained her chin. Her eyes were bloodshot and horrified, but she wasn't screaming, thank Christ.
Who?
She said, and stopped, putting her wrist to her wounded mouth. She looked down at the dead man on the ground, shook her head as though unable to believe it, and looked at Ian.
"These should not have done this," she said, low-voiced and urgent.
"Do you have a better suggestion?"
Ian asked, getting some of his breath back.
"He would have left," she said,
and glanced over her shoulder as though expecting his nemesis to appear.
When he had finished?
"He's finished,"
Ian assured her, and moving slowly, got up onto his knees.
"You'll be Mrs. Hardman, then?"
"I am Sylvia Hardman."
She couldn't keep her eyes off the dead man.
"He's friend Jamie's nephew, Mummy,"
said a small, clear voice behind him. All three girls had clustered behind their mother, all of them looking shocked. Even the little one was round-eyed and silent, her thumb in her mouth.
"Jamie,"
Sylvia Hardman said, and shook her head. The dazed expression was fading from her face, and she dabbed at her swelling lip with a fold of the tattered wrapper she wore.
"Jamie Fraser?"
"Aye," Ian said, and got to his feet. He was battered and stiff, but it wasn't hurting much yet.
"He sent me to see to your welfare."
She looked incredulously at him, then at Frederick's, back at him, and began to laugh. It wasn't regular laughing. It was a high, thin, hysterical sound, and she put a hand over her mouth to stop it.
"I suppose I'd best get rid of this."
He towed Frederick's body in the thigh.
"Will anyone come looking for him?"
"They might."
Sylvia was getting her own breath back.
"This is Charles Fredericks. He's a judge. Justice Fredericks of the City Court of Philadelphia."
Ian regarded the dead justice for a moment, then glanced at Mrs. Hardman. Bar that moment of unhinged laughter, she hadn't been hysterical, and while she was paler than the grubby shift she wore, she was composed. Not merely composed, he noted with interest. She was grimly intent, her gaze focused on the body.
"Will they help me to hide him?"
she asked, looking up. He nodded.
"Will someone come looking for him? Come here, I mean."
The house was isolated, a mile at least from any other dwelling, and a good 5 miles outside the city.
"I don't know," she said frankly, meeting his eyes. "He's been coming once or twice a week for the last 2 months, and he's..."
"He was," she corrected, with a slight tone of relief in her voice.
"A blabbermouth. Once he'd got what he came for, he'd drink and he'd talk. Mostly about himself, but now and then he'd mention men he knew and what he thought of them. Not much, as a rule."
"So you think he might have boasted about coming here?"
She uttered a short, startled laugh.
"Here?"
"No. He might have talked about the Quaker widow he was swiving, though. Some people know about me."
Dull red splotches came up on her face and neck, and looking at them, Ian saw the darker marks of bruises on her neck.
"Mummy?"
The girls were all shivering.
"Can we go inside now, Mummy? It's awful cold."
Mrs. Hardman shook herself, and straightening, stepped in front of the dead man, at least partially blocking the girls' view of his body.
"Yes. Go in the house, girls. Build up the fire. There's some food in a valise. Go ahead and eat. Feed Chastity. I'll be in presently."
She swallowed visibly. Ian couldn't tell whether it was from sudden nausea or simple hunger at mention of food. The shadow of her bones showed in her chest. The little girl sidled past the body, Patience with her hands over Chastity's eyes, and disappeared into the house, though Prudence lingered at the door until her mother made a shooing gesture, at which she also vanished.
"I think we canna just bury him," Ian said. "If anyone should come here looking for him, a fresh grave wouldn't be that hard to find. Can you get him dressed, do you think?"
Her eyes went round, and she glanced at the body, then back at Ian. Her mouth opened, then closed.
"I can,"
she said, sounding breathless.
"Do that, then," he said.
He looked up at the sky. It was the colour of tarnished pewter, and still spitting a few random snowflakes. He could feel more coming, though. There was a sense of the north wind on the back of his neck.
"I'll be back before the evening comes," he said, turning toward his horse. "Pack what you can. That horse is his, I expect."
There was a fine-looking bay gelding twitching his ears under the sparse shelter of a leafless tulip tree. Clearly it didn't belong to the Hardman household.
"Yes. I'll need to use that one to move the body, but I'll bring another to help carry you and the bairns."
Sylvia blinked and pushed a lank strand of hair behind her ear.
"Where are we going?"
He grinned at her, reassuringly, he hoped.
"I'm taking you to meet my mother."
Ian took a bit of time riding toward Philadelphia. There was no shortage of suitable places for what he had in mind, but it was more than likely that he'd have to do it in the dark. Once he'd found it, a thicket of mixed oak and pine with a towering single pine behind it that would be visible against even the night sky, he dismounted and scrabbled about until he found what he wanted. This he stuffed into his saddlebag and spurred up along the Philadelphia road. He managed to hire a sturdy horse with a kind eye from a farm 2 miles out, and returned with it to find the Hardmans wearing everything they possessed, with the remainder of their meagre belongings wrapped up in a ratty quilt tied with string. Mrs. Hardman, he noticed, had a crudely made knife with a string-wrapped handle thrust through her belt. This seemed slightly odd for a professed friend, but then he realized that it was likely her only knife, used for chopping vegetables, butchering, and digging in the garden. Likely she'd never considered stabbing anyone with it. If she had, he thought, grunting with effort as he and Sylvia manhandled the justice over the saddle of his own horse, this fellow would have died long before now.
"All right," he said, jerking the rope that bound the corpse tight. "Mrs. Hardman."
"Call me Sylvia, friend," she said. "And thee is Ian?"
"I am," he said, and patted her shoulder gently. "Ian Murray. Can you ride at all, Sylvia?"
"I haven't for some years," she said,
biting her lip as she examined the horse he intended for her.
"But I will."
"Aye, this fellow doesn't seem a bad sort, and you won't be galloping at all, so dinna fash too much about it. So, you'll ride him, with prudence behind you and chastity before."
He thought the three of them together didn't equal his weight, and he was not a burly man.
"Wait a moment. Thee should take this, I think."
Sylvia reached down and picked up a leather valise from the ground. It wasn't new, but had clearly been a piece of some quality in its prime. It smelled of apples.
"Oh," he said, realizing.
He glanced at the justice's horse, which wasn't at all happy with its burden, but not disposed to create a ruckus.
Not yet, anyway. "It's his."
"Yes. He brought us food every time he came."
Her eye lingered on the awkward shape, but her face was unreadable.
"That's not a bad epitaph," he told her, taking the valise. "When my time comes, I hope mine is as good. Mount up. I'll take care of this."
He helped her up, then lifted Prudence, who squealed with excitement, and Chastity, who just stared round-eyed and sucked her thumb hard.
"Patience. You'll come with me, aye?"
He tied the bundle of possessions at the back of his saddle, boosted Patience up in front, and then swung up behind her, a rope to the bridle of the justice's horse in one hand. He clicked his tongue to the horses, and the grim little cavalcade lurched off into the lightly falling snow. None of the Hardmans looked back. Ian did. Feeling obscurely that a place where people had dwelt for a long time deserved at least a word of farewell. The house was small and grey and beaten, its hearth cold and the fire long dead. And yet it had sheltered a family, had witnessed a meeting of the Continental Generals, had given Uncle Jamie refuge when he needed it.
"Go back to the earth in peace. You have done well,"
he said quietly to the house. Patience clutched the pommel like grim death, and he could feel her shivering against him, despite the several layers of flimsy garments she wore.
"Have you ever been on a horse before, lass?"
She nodded, breathless.
"Daddy would put me and Prue up on his nag now and then, but we never did more than walk round the yard."
"Well, that's something. Your father's dead, I take it."
"Maybe," she said sadly. "Mummy thinks the militia shot him because they thought he was a loyalist. Me and Prue think maybe Indians took him. But he's been gone since before Chastity was born, so he's likely dead. Otherwise, don't you think he would have got free and come back to us?"
"I do," Ian assured her. "But, Kent, Indians can be good folk. I'm a Mohawk myself."
"This?"
She turned round in the saddle to stare at him with a combination of interest and horror.
"I am."
He tapped the tattooed lines that ran across his cheekbones.
"They adopted me, and I lived with them for some time. A Sebuim, willingly, mind. But I did come back to my family at last. Maybe your da will do the same." And if he did, he wondered, looking at the wraith-like shapes of Sylvia Hardman and her daughters on the horse ahead of him. What would he do when he found out the shifts his absence had put his wife to? And what shifts has Emily been put to without a man? She'd have people, though.
A Mohawk woman would never be alone in the way Sylvia Hardman was alone, and that thought comforted him slightly. When they reached the Philadelphia Road, he dismounted carefully, led his horse up to Sylvia's, and tied a neck rope to the pommel of her saddle, in case Patience should lose hold of the reins.
"You go on ahead," he said to Sylvia, and pointed down the road, which was broad, clear, and empty in the waning light. "You mustn't be anywhere near me while I'm taking care of Mr. Fredericks."
She shuddered at the name, casting a haunted glance back at the humped shape on the third horse's back.
"With luck, I'll catch you up within half an hour," he said. "There's nae moon, but it's a snow-lit sky. I think you'll be able to see the road even after full dark. If anyone offers to molest you, tell them your husband is behind you and ride on. Give them your bundle if they want it, but don't let them get you off the horses."
"Yes." Her voice was high with fear, and she coughed to lower it.
"We will. We won't, I mean.
Thank you, Ian."
He took them half a mile down the Philadelphia Road to be sure they could manage the horses. They were only walking, but you never kent when something might happen, and he warned them about paying attention and keeping hold of the reins. Patience's eyes were round as saucers when he slid off and tucked the reins into her hands.
"Alone?" she said, in a very small voice. "I'm riding alone?"
"Not for long," he assured her, "and your mam will be holding the rope. I'll be back, quick as I can."
He untied Frederick's horse then, and led the gelding in the other direction, well past the lane that led to the Hardman cottage. It was beginning to snow in earnest, but the flakes were small and hard, and only skittered across the hard-packed road, the wind making thin white lines on the dirt. Being in the open, in possession of a fresh corpse, was never comfortable, but it was particularly uneasy work when in the vicinity of white people, who were inclined to think everyone's private business was also theirs. Luckily, the cold weather had kept the body from swelling, and it wasn't making eerie noises yet. There it was, the tall pine, black against the snow-lit sky. He trampled down a patch of brush on his previous visit, and now led the horse carefully into it, and between two close-spaced saplings. The horse was suspicious, but did follow, and one of the saplings gave way with a crack.
"Good a havitch," he murmured. "Nae more than another minute, all right."
Beyond the scrim of oak and pine saplings, the land plunged down into a small ravine. He'd counted the steps to the edge of it on his first visit, and a good thing. The light was poor, and the ravine full of brush and straggly small trees. He tied up the horse a safe distance from the edge, then untied Frederick's, and hauled him off, dropping him to the ground with a thud like a killed buffalo. Ian dragged the late justice to the edge of the ravine, then went back to the foot of the big pine to retrieve the broken dead branch he'd selected earlier. The stick he'd used before was clearly from a fruit tree. He pulled it out and put it in his pouch for later disposal. He wondered whether there was a Gallic charm or prayer to cover the disposal of the body of someone you'd murdered, but if there was, he didn't know it. The Mohawk had prayers all right, but they didn't bother much with the dead.
"I'll ask Uncle Jimmy later," he said to Fredericks under his breath, "and if there is one, I'll say it for you. For now, though, you're on your own."
He felt his way over the cold, hard face, located the empty eye socket, and drove the sharp end of his branch into it as hard as he could. The scrape of bark and wood on bone, and then the sudden yielding, raised the hairs across his shoulders and down his arms. Then he dragged the body to the edge of the ravine and pushed it over. For a moment, he feared it wouldn't move, but it slid on the pine needles and after a long moment rolled almost lazily once, twice, and disappeared into the brush at the bottom with a muffled crunch that was scarcely to be heard above the rising wind. He was tempted to keep the horse. If anyone noticed it, he could just say he'd found it wandering on the road. But if he and the horse were to remain in company with Sylvia Hardman and her wains in Philadelphia, it was too dangerous, and he took the horse back to the road and bade it farewell with a slap on the rump. He watched it go, then turned round and began to jog up the road in the thickening snow. Chapter 78. The Smells of Blood. Ian had come in, quietly, like an Indian, Rachel thought, sometime past midnight, crouching by the bed and blowing softly in her ear to rouse her, lest he startle her and wake Oggie. She'd hastily checked the latter, then swung her feet out of bed and rose to embrace her husband.
"He smells of blood," she whispered. "What has he killed?"
"A beast," he whispered back, and cupped her cheek in his palm. "I had to, but I'm no sorry for it."
She nodded, feeling a sharp stone forming in her throat.
"Will you come out with me, Maneon Dun? I need help."
She nodded again and turned to find the cloak she used for a bedgown. There was a sense of grimness about him, but something else as well, and she couldn't tell what it was. She was hoping that he hadn't brought the body home with the expectation that she would help him bury or hide it, whatever or whoever it was. But he had just killed something he considered to be evil, and perhaps felt himself pursued. She was therefore taken aback when she followed him into the tiny parlour of their rooms and found a scrawny woman with a battered face and three grubby, half-starved children, clothed in rags, pressed together on the sofa like a row of terrified owls.
"Friend Sylvia," Ian said softly, "this is my wife, Rachel."
"Friend?"
Rachel said, astonished but heartened.
"Thee is a friend?"
The woman nodded, uncertain.
"I am,"
she said, and her voice was soft but clear.
"We are. I am Sylvia Hardman, and these are my daughters, Patience, Prudence, and Little Chastity." "They'll be needing something to eat, Macrea. And then maybe..."
"A little hot water," Sylvia Hardman blurted. "Please, to wash."
Her hands were clenched on her knees, crumpling the faded homespun, and Rachel gave the hands a quick look. Possibly she had helped Ian in his killing? The stone was hard in her throat again, but she nodded, touching the smallest of the little girls, a pretty, round-faced babe, somewhere between 1 and 2, more than half asleep on a sister's lap.
"Right away," she promised. "Ian, get thy mother."
"I'm here," Jenny said from behind her.
Her voice was alert and interested.
"I see we've got company."
Rachel went at once to the sideboard and found bread and cheese and apples, which she distributed to the two older girls. The little one had fallen sound asleep. So Rachel lifted her gently and took her into the bedroom where she tucked her in beside Oggie. The little girl was grimy and thin, her dark curls matted, but she was otherwise in good condition, and her sweet round face had an innocence that Rachel thought her sisters had long since lost. The why of that became apparent directly. Jenny had ignored food and brought Sylvia Hardman hot water, soap, and a towel. Sylvia was washing herself slowly and thoroughly, her brows drawn together in concentration, looking at nothing. Ian glanced briefly at her and then explained the situation to Rachel and his mother simply and bluntly, despite the presence of the children. Rachel glanced at the little girls and raised her brows at her husband, but he merely said, "They were there," and continued.
"So I got rid of him," he concluded. "You dinna need to ken how or where."
One of the girls let out a little sigh of what might have been relief or sheer exhaustion.
"Aye," Jenny said, dismissing this, "and you couldna leave them where they were in case someone came looking for the man and found him too close."
"Partly that, aye."
Despite the hour, and the fact that he had spent the previous day and half the night engaged in what must have been very strenuous activity, Ian seemed wide awake and in full possession of his faculties. He smiled at his mother.
"Uncle Jimmy told me that if friend Sylvia was to be in any difficulty, I was to take care of it."
Sylvia Hardman began to laugh, very quietly, but with a distinct edge of hysteria. Jenny sat down beside her, put her arm round Sylvia's shoulders, and Sylvia stopped laughing abruptly. Rachel saw that her hands, still wet and slippery with soap, were shaking.
"Does thee believe in angels, Rachel?" Sylvia asked.
Her voice was low and slightly distorted because of her swollen lip.
"If thee means Ian or Jamie, they would firmly abjure any such description," Rachel said, smiling reassuringly and trying not to look away from the wide bruise that cut across Sylvia's face and made her eyes look strangely disconnected from the rest of her features.
"But having known them both for some time, I do think God occasionally finds some use for them."
Chapter 79 Too Many Women. In the morning, Jenny took charge of the children so that Rachel could go with Sylvia Hardman to talk to the weighty friends, which was as far as a Quaker would go in attributing status to anyone, who were presently in charge of Philadelphia yearly meeting, and see whether some provision of housing, work, or money might be arranged for the Hardman succour. Ian would have accompanied them, but both Rachel and Sylvia expressed doubt that his presence would be helpful.
"I don't plan to mention the beast that thee killed," Rachel had said to him privately. "Thus, thy testimony is likely to cause more trouble, not less. Besides, thee has business of thine own, does thee not?"
"Not my own, no," he said, and kissed her briefly. "But I promised Auntie Clare I'd pay a visit to a brothel on her behalf."
She didn't turn a single dark brown hair. "Don't bring home a whore," she advised him. "Thee already has too many women."
Elfrith's alley was not bad, as alleys in a city went. Hardly a proper alley at all, Ian thought, skirting a small heap of vomit on the bricks. It was wide enough that you could drive a wagon down it, and several of the houses had polished brass doorknobs. Mother Abbott's did, even though this was the back door of the establishment, but naturally the back door of a whorehouse would be used as much, if not much more, than the front. There were two young whores sitting on the back steps, wrapped in cloaks, and he wondered whether they were there as advertisement or only taking a breath of air. It was crisp out, and their breaths rose in white wisps, vanishing as they talked. One of them spotted him, and they stopped. The taller one eyed him briefly, then leaned back, one elbow on the step behind her, and let her cloak fall back from one shoulder, showing a glimpse of pink skin above her shift, and the rounded weight of her breast through it. He smiled at her. Her face changed, and he realized that she'd just noticed his tattoos. She looked wary, but she didn't look away.
"Good day to you, mistress," he said,
and her eyebrows shot up at his Scottish accent. Her friends sat up straight and stared hard at him. He came to a stop in front of them, tilted back his head and looked up. The house rose above him, three stories of solid red brick.
"A good house, is it?"
he asked. The whores exchanged glances, and he saw the short one shrug slightly, relinquishing him to her taller comrade, who straightened up but left her cloak hanging carelessly open. The cold made her nipples poke out, round and hard under the thin cotton.
"Very good indeed, sir," she said, and gave him a practiced smile. She got her feet under her, preparing to rise. "Will you come in and have a drink to take the chill off?"
"Maybe," he said, smiling at her. "But I meant, is it a good place for you ladies?"
Their faces went blank, and they stared up at him, mouths hanging open in astonishment. The shorter one, with dishevelled blonde hair, recovered first.
"Well, it's better nor doing it out of a carriage or having a pimp what sends you into drinking barns and boxing rings. I'll say that much."
"Trixie." The tall, brown-haired lass kicked at her companion and rose to her feet, smiling at him.
"I'm Meg. It's a good clean house, sir, and the girls are all clean, healthy, and well-fed."
She cupped a hand under her very healthy breast in illustration. He nodded and reached into his pouch, withdrawing his purse, plump with coin.
"I'm healthy too, lass."
The short one tossed her head.
"That's as may be. Everyone says Scotchmen are mean."
Her tall friend kicked her again, harder.
"Ow!"
"Scotsmen are canny, lass, not mean," Ian said, ignoring this byplay. "We want value for money, aye? But if it's value we get..."
He tossed the purse lightly, catching it in his palm, so the money chinked. The tall lassie came down the steps and stopped in front of him, close, her cold nipples near enough that he imagined them pressing against his bare chest, and felt the hairs there prickle.
"Forgive me, Rachel," he thought.
"Oh, I can promise you value, sir," she said, smiling through the wisps of her breath. "Whatever you desire."
He nodded amiably, looking her frankly up and down.
"What I want, lass, is a girl with a good bit of experience."
Her face changed at that, and he saw that he'd frightened her a little. Maybe not a bad thing.
"Do you have any girls who've worked in the house for, oh, say, 5 years at least?"
5 years?
The short one blurted. She scrambled to her feet, and at first he thought she meant to flee, but she just wanted a closer look at him. She looked him over with as much frankness as he'd displayed with her friend, but with an air of fascination as well.
"What on earth can a whore do that takes 5 years to learn?"
She sounded as though she truly wanted to find out, and he looked at her with more interest. She might think he was a pervert, but she was game, and he was that wee bit shocked to find it aroused him more than Meg's nipples. He cleared his throat.
"I'd like to ken the answer to that one too, lass," he said, smiling at her. "But what I want just now is a girl who kent Jane Pocock."
Chapter 80. A word for that. The streets of Philadelphia were filled with food. At least they were when the British Army wasn't occupying the city. It wasn't at the moment, and there were pies for sale, both meat and fruit. Big, salt-dusted German bretzeln, carried on sticks like a ring toss. Fried fish, sugar-dusted crullers, stuffed cabbage leaves, and buckets of beer. All available within footsteps of the building where the Philadelphia yearly meeting of the Society of Friends conducted most of its business. Unfortunately, most of the available food wasn't of a style or shape that would make throwing it against a wall very satisfying. Fuming, Rachel glanced to and fro and settled on an apple seller.
"Here," she said,
handing one of the yellow and pink fruits to Sylvia Hardman. Sylvia looked at it in surprise, then lifted it uncertainly toward her mouth.
"No," Rachel said, "like this,"
and turning on her heel, she drew back her arm and flung the apple as hard as she could against the trunk of a massive oak tree that stood in the park where they'd gone to gather themselves. The apple exploded into bits and juice, and Rachel drew a satisfied breath.
"Imagine it is the head of friend Sharpless," she advised Sylvia. "Or perhaps that oaf Phineas Cadwallader."
"Oh, him, to be sure."
Sylvia's face was as flushed as the apple, and with a little oomph she hurled her fruit at the tree, but missed. Rachel ran to fetch it back, then guided Sylvia closer to the tree.
"Put thy fingers so," she said. "Then draw thy arm back and fix thy eye firmly upon the spot thee has chosen. Then throw, but do not let thine eye stray."
Sylvia nodded, and taking a fresh grip upon the apple, faced the tree with the fire she should have shown to Fred Cadwallader, and let fly.
"Oh!"
She made a small sound of pleased surprise.
"I didn't think I could."
She laughed, but self-consciously, looking over her shoulder.
"I suppose this is sinfully wasteful, but..."
"Ask the squirrels if they think so," Rachel advised, nodding toward one of these creatures who had rushed down the trunk of the tree within seconds of the first impact, and was now on the ground, stuffing itself with the fragments of their bombardment.
Sylvia looked, then glanced around. At least a dozen more were bounding across the grass, tails bushy with purpose.
"Well, then," she said, and drew a deep breath. "Thee is right. I feel much calmer."
"Good.
Can thee eat?" Rachel asked.
"I'm starved. Perhaps we might have a pie and discuss what to do next."
The calmness at once disappeared from Sylvia's face, replaced with pale apprehension, but she nodded and obediently followed Rachel back onto the street.
"I should not have gone," Sylvia said, pausing after a bite or two of her beef and onion pie. "I knew what they would say."
"Yes, thee told me, but I didn't want to believe it."
Rachel bit into her own pie, frowning.
"That people who profess charity and the love of Christ could speak in such a way. No wonder thy husband turned his back upon them."
"Gabriel wasn't one to stand what he thought of as interference," Sylvia agreed ruefully. "But thee can see their point, surely. I am, in fact, exactly what they said. A whore."
Rachel wanted to contradict her on the spot, but having opened her mouth to do so, paused, then took another bite of flaky pastry and gravy.
"Thee had no choice," she said, after chewing and swallowing.
"Mr. Cadwallader appeared to think I had," Sylvia said, a little tartly. "I should have married again."
"But thee didn't know whether thy husband was dead. How could thee marry?"
"Or come to the city and turn my hand to laundry or needlework,
which wouldn't pay thee enough to feed thyself, let alone thy daughters."
"Perhaps friend Cadwallader hasn't found occasion to discover what the life of a laundress is like," Sylvia said.
She finished her pie and her bony shoulders slumped a little, relaxing in the late afternoon sun.
"I suppose we must look for the light within him and Fred Sharples, mustn't we?"
"Yes," Rachel said reluctantly.
"But I may require a few more apples and a bottle of beer before such a search might be effective."
Sylvia laughed, and Rachel's heart rose to hear it.
Sylvia Hardman was battered, no doubt of it, but not yet broken. "Still, it would have been good to be part of a meeting once again," Sylvia said wistfully. "I have not had such company or support in many years."
Rachel swallowed her last bite and took hold of Sylvia's hand. It was slender, calloused, and ill-used, bearing the burns and scars of unrelenting toil and many small household disasters.
"Wherever two or more of you are gathered in my name, there am I," Rachel said,
and pointed at Sylvia, then herself.
"One, two."
Sylvia smiled despite herself, and her true nature, kind and humorous, peeped out behind the wariness in her eyes.
"Then thee is my meeting, Rachel."
I am blessed. Ian came back from his visit to Elfrith's Alley in something of a brown study, oblivious to the shouts of dairymaids and beer sellers. He'd thought he might have to expend considerable time and money in order to get the inhabitants of the brothel to talk, but the mere mention of Jane Pocock's name had opened floodgates of gossip, and he felt, as one might after being washed overboard from a ship and carried ashore in a flurry of foam and sharp debris. Now he wished he had paid more attention to Fanny's drawing of her sister. The loudly stated opinion of Mrs. Abbott, the madam, was that Jane Pocock had been strange, plainly very strange, demented, and probably a practitioner of strange arts. And how it was that neither she nor any of her girls had been murdered in their bed, she did not know. Ian wondered why a young woman with such skills would have been working as a whore, but didn't say so under the circumstances. It took some time for the talk about the murder of Captain Harkness to die down, but Ian Murray did ken his way around a brothel, and when the flow diminished, he at once ordered two more extortionately priced bottles of champagne. This altered the air of accommodation to something more focused but less vituperative, and within half an hour Mrs. Abbott had retreated to her sanctum, and the whores had reached their own silent accommodation amongst themselves. He found himself on the red velvet sofa, common to such establishments, with Meg on one side and Trixabella on the other.
Trix was friends with Arabella, Jane, I mean, Meg explained.
Trix nodded, doleful.
Wish I hadn't been, she said. That girl hadn't any luck at all, and that kind of thing can brush off on you, you know.
What are those things on your face?
Can it?
Ian touched his cheekbone. It's a mohawk tattoo.
Oh, said Trix, with slightly more interest. Was you captured by Indians?
She giggled at the thought.
Nay, I went on my own accord, he said equably.
Well, me too,
Trix said, with an up-tilted chin and a wave of the hand, presumably meant to draw his attention to the relatively luxurious nature of her place of employment.
Not Arabella, though. Mrs. Abbott got her and her sister off a sea captain, what didn't have the scratch to pay his bill. Those girls were indentures.
Aye? And how long ago was that? You can't have been here more than a year or two yourself.
In fact, she looked to have been in the trade for a decade at least, but minor gallantries were part of the expected pourparlers, and she laughed and batted her eyes at him in a practised manner.
Reckon it would have been 6, maybe 7 years ago.
Time flies when you're having fun, or so they say.
Tempus fugit.
Ian filled her glass and clinked his against it, smiling. She dimpled professionally, drank, and went on.
Mind, I wasn't but 2 years older than Jane. Bat, bat. Mrs. Abbott wouldn't have bothered with them, save they were pretty, both of them. And Jane was just about old enough to, start.
Ian was counting back. 6 years ago, Jane would have been about the age Fanny was now.
Old enough.
After a few accounts of harrowing initial experiences in the trade, he managed to drag the conversation back to Jane and Fanny.
You said a sea captain sold the girls to Mrs. Abbott. Do either of you, by chance, recall his name?
Meg shook her head.
I wasn't here, she said.
Trix? She lifted a brow at her friend, who frowned a little and pressed her lips together.
Has he come back here since?
Ian asked, watching her closely.
She looked startled. Well, yes. I only saw him twice, mind, and it's been a long while, so I maybe don't recall his name for sure.
Ian sighed, gave her a direct look, and handed her a golden guinea.
Vasquez, she said without hesitation. Sebastian Vasquez.
Was he a Spaniard?
Ian asked, his mind having smoothly transmuted her rendering to Sebastian Vasquez.
I don't know, Trix said frankly. I've never had a Spaniard, knowing like I mean. Wouldn't know what they sound like.
They all sound the same in bed, Meg said, giving Ian an eye. Trix gave her friend a withering look.
We sounded foreign-like, no doubt about that. And no talking through his nose or that wah, wah, wah sort of thing Frenchies do.
I've had 3 Frenchmen, she explained to Ian with a small showing of pride.
Was a few of them in Philadelphia while the British Army was here.
When was the last time Vasquez came here? He asked.
Maybe close to 3 years ago.
Did he go with Jane then? Ian asked.
No, Trix said unexpectedly. He went with me. She made a face.
He stank of gunpowder, like an artilleryman. He wasn't one, though. They've all got it ground into their skins and their hands are black with it. But he was clean, though he smelled like a fired pistol.
A thought occurred to Ian, though thinking was becoming difficult. He wasn't bothered by the fact that his body was taking strong notice of the girls, but arousal seldom did much for the mental faculties.
Could you tell if he was still a sea captain? He asked.
Both girls looked blank.
I mean, did he mention his ship? Or maybe say he was taking on crew, anything like that? Did he smell of the sea or fish?
That made them both laugh.
No, just gunpowder, Trix said, recovering.
Mother Abbott called him captain, though, Trix added, and 'twas clear enough he weren't a soldier. A few more questions emptied both bottles, and it was clear that the girls had told him all they knew, little as it was. At least he had a name. There were sounds in the house, opening doors, heavy footsteps, men's voices and women's greetings. It was just past tea time, and the Cullies were beginning to come in. He rose, arranged himself without shame, and bowed to them, thanking them for their kind assistance. At the bottom of the stairs, he heard Trix call down to him and looked up to see her leaning over the rail of the landing above.
"Aye," he said.
She glanced round to make sure there was no one near, then scuttled down the stairs and took him by the sleeve.
"I'll know one thing more," she said. "When Mother Abbott went to sell Arabella's maidenhead, she hadn't one, so they had to use a bladder of chicken blood."
Sylvia sent her girls off with a tray loaded with food to eat in the bedroom. Then she sat down at the table where Jenny and Rachel had laid out 6 slices of bread on which to serve the bacon and beans, they having no more than the 2 warped wooden plates that had been provided with their rooms. Ian thought the smell of food might be enough to knock him over. He couldn't recall the last time he'd eaten. He thought it might have been yesterday sometime, but he'd been too busy to notice. He broke off a corner of bread with a good bit of beans cooked with bacon and onions on it, shoveled it into his mouth, and made an involuntary sound that caused all the women to look at him.
"You sound like a starving wolf, lad," his mother said, raising her brows.
Rachel laughed, and Sylvia smiled very gingerly. She ate the same way, owing to her split lip, and he thought, from the tentative way she chewed, that a couple of her teeth might have been loosened as well. If he'd had any compunction about killing Judge Frederick, and he hadn't, it would have vanished on the spot. He felt much the same toward the so-called friends of the yearly meeting. Rachel had told him a good bit about the nature of Quaker meetings, and he understood that while anyone was welcome to sit and to worship with them, it was a different thing to be part of the meeting. People were accepted only after consideration and conference. There was something akin to the way a clan worked in this. There was an expectation of obligation that went both ways. So he could understand, he supposed, why the Friends of Philadelphia hadn't simply scooped Sylvia into their bosoms. Still, he resented them for it.
"Friends are ideally meant to be compassionate, peaceable, and honest," Rachel said, frowning. "This does not mean that they reserve judgment, nor that they don't possess strong opinions, which they are, of course, welcome to express."
"And they gossip?"
Ian asked.
Rachel sighed. "We do. I mean," she added, "we discourage anything in the way of ill-natured gossip, spreading scandal or personal disparagement.
but by the nature of a meeting, everyone knows everyone else's business.
Aye.
Ian scraped a last bit of bread around the rim of the pot, salvaging the rest of the succulent juice.
Well, friend Sylvia's business is none of theirs.
Do you have a notion of what you'd like to do, or where you want to go, lass? He asked, addressing Sylvia.
We'll help you do it, regardless.
I wish to go with you, Sylvia blurted.
A red tide surged up her thin neck and blotched her cheeks.
I know I haven't any right to ask you, but I do.
Rachel at once looked at Ian, and so did his mother.
Well, he was the man, and it was his fault they were here, so he supposed he had a right to decide how many women he could reasonably juggle. Still,
I do not wish to remain in Philadelphia, Sylvia said. She'd got hold of herself, and her voice was steady. Since yearly meeting knows who I am, both by name and reputation, she added, with a slight note of bitterness, I will find no acceptance here. Any meeting that took me in would soon realize their mistake. And while I could earn a living as an actual whore, I will not, on any account, expose my daughters to such a life.
Aye, Ian said reluctantly. I suppose you're right. But we're bound for New York, lass, and the country of the Haudenosaunee.
That's the Iroquois League, Rachel put in. More specifically, we're bound for a small town called Canajoharie, inhabited by the Mohawk.
I suppose I might find a place somewhere before we reach Canajoharie. But if not, have the Mohawk any objection to whores? Sylvia asked, a small frown creasing the flesh between her brows.
They dinna really have a word for that, Ian said, and if they dinna have a word for something, it's no important.
Oggy, who had been having an earnest conversation with his toes, looked up at this point, said,
Da!
Very clearly, and then returned to his toes. Ian smiled, then sighed deeply and addressed his son.
Three women and three wee lasses. I'm sure you'll be as much aid to me as you can, Avalach. But there's no help for it. I'll need another man.
Chapter 81. Still imminent. It had been one of those beautiful autumn days when the sun is bright and warm at its zenith, but a chill creeps in at dawn and dusk, and the nights are cold enough to make a good fire, a good thick quilt, and a good man with a lot of body heat in bed beside you more than welcome. The good man in question stretched himself groaning and relapsed into the luxury of rest with a sigh, his hand on my thigh. I patted it and rolled toward him, dislodging Adso, who had alighted at the foot of the bed, but leapt off with a brief burp of annoyance at this indication that we didn't mean to lapse into immobility just yet.
So, Sassenach, what have you been doing all day? Jamie asked, stroking my hip.
His eyes were half closed in the drowsy pleasure of warmth, but focused on my face.
Oh, Lord.
Dawn seemed an eon ago, but I stretched myself and eased comfortably into his touch. Just chores for the most part. But a man named Herman Mortensen came up from Woolham's Mill in late morning to have a pilonidal cyst at the base of his spine lanced and evacuated. I haven't smelled anything that bad since Bluebell rolled in a decayed pig's carcass. But then, I added, sensing that this might not